Acts chapter 23 is where we are at. I will deal with verses 12 to 22. Aaron, Jenny, good to have you, man. The town is missing you. Hello, Indigo.
Hello.
Good to have you guys, man. Really good to see you. All right, let's just recap where we were last week. If you were not here, let's just quickly go over that. We witnessed last week Paul, let me just switch on this bad boy over here, that Paul finds himself standing before the Sanhedrin, the 71 leaders of Israel, the supreme judicial council of the Jewish nation, 70 top guys. And it was supposed to be a fair court type of situation, right? As he stands in front of these guys, they are supposed to judge cases like this righteously. Okay, with God's mind in their minds. But it was a crazy and pathetic judgment scene. Because the high priest, for example, he orders the servants to give Paul a smack in the face the moment that Paul just tries to say something. That doesn't sound like a fair trial. But Paul then goes and he puts a curse, or we could say a prophecy, on the high priest, which history tells us actually happened. This high priest, Ananias, he was actually assassinated not too long after that. And so God judged him. But throughout this trial, we see that Paul is really submissive to the law of God, especially when he realized that the man he had just cursed was actually the high priest. Immediately he repents. That's a wonderful character of Paul. But we also see that Paul is extremely wise as he, with one sentence, preaches the gospel and also manages to throw a bone in the works and causes a great division, which helps him ultimately to survive this trial. It was a crazy and pathetic judgment scene. If we summarize it, we see face slaps, curses, confusion, insults, disputes, divisions, uproars, and violence. The leaders of God's people, this is what happens, and this is gives you understanding as to why God destroyed the Israelites, why he tore down the temple in Jerusalem in AD 70. But directly after that, one night, Paul had a tough day at the office, all right? It was tough. He gets home the next night. He's in the barracks. He's in prison. We'll talk about that tonight. And Jesus appears to him, and Jesus cheers him up and comforts him. And he says to him, listen, you've testified about me in Jerusalem so well. Well done, Paul. I've got news for you. You're going to go to Rome and you're going to do the same thing over there. And I think we need to keep that in our minds tonight as well. I think that was comforting for Paul, because I think there were moments that he probably thought he's going to die in Jerusalem. And we know that Paul wanted to go to Rome, right? So where do we stand at this point? Just go on this journey with me quickly. Just imagine, and I hope that you're with me. Hope so, that I'm losing nobody here. He's gone through the trial with the Sanhedrin. The Jews are upset with him. Where does everybody stand now? Let's just imagine for a moment. Where's Lysias? Now, Lysias, you know, he's the commander that saved Paul from the crowd, right? So where's he standing after this trial? Why did he take Paul to the trial? Because he wanted the issue to be resolved. Is Paul guilty or not? Shall he be executed or not? Do we have to take this to a higher level? What is going on? Right? So Lysias, I don't think his problem is solved yet. He's still a little bit annoyed, because he hoped it would be resolved now, right? It's not resolved. He had to go save Paul again from these guys. Okay? So he still doesn't know what to do with Paul. So he is a prisoner with him, and he doesn't know what to do with him. Where does Paul stand? Paul, I think, my opinion, Paul is amused. They can't corner this guy. They can't corner him. They can't convict him. And every time he gets sort of into trouble, he preaches the gospel. He gets to just speak about Jesus wherever he goes. He's in front of the crowd by the side of the barracks. He preaches the gospel to them. He's taken to the Sanhedrin. He tells them, the reason why I'm standing on trial before you today is because I believe in the resurrection of the dead. And so that refers to Jesus. He gets to preach the gospel. I think that's incredible. And now He knows for a fact where is he going. He's going to Rome. So he knows he's not going to die in Jerusalem. The tickets are booked, ladies and gentlemen. He's going to Rome. Life is great for Paul. What about God? Where does God stand in this? I think God is proud of Paul for preaching the gospel, even though it is so uncomfortable. Everything is going according to God's plan. God is always one step ahead of the crowd. He's always one step ahead of the Sanhedrin. And he's always one step ahead of the people that are employed by Satan. What about the Jews? How do you think they feel at this moment? The Jews, ladies and gentlemen, they are mad. They are mad. They want Paul to shut up. And they want him dead. They want his message removed from the earth forever. They despise Paul. They believe that Paul deserves death, but they cannot prove it. They cannot convict the guy. They believe he is guilty, but they cannot show it. Paul is like a wet bar of soap. They can't grab onto him. He keeps slipping away. They have lied. They have fabricated witnesses. They have intimidated. They have beat him, and they keep on getting away. Nowhere. Why? Because they're fighting against God. That's what happens when you fight against God. They are frustrated. And this is the point where they simply need to accept they're in the wrong team. They need to accept it. We're in the wrong team, but what do they do? That's what we get in with tonight. What do they do at the conclusion of this trial? This is what the text says. Verse 12. The next morning, some Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they have killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. They went to the chief priests and the elders and said, "We have taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin, petition the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case. We are ready to kill him before he gets here." While Paul is being comforted and cheered by Jesus, a bunch of Sadducee zealots are being deceived and deployed by Satan to lie and to commit murder. If we can't find Paul guilty through legitimate means, we need to take matters into our own hands. We need to find a way to kill him. Now, I've been wondering about this, like, where was Paul? And why didn't they just go kill him where he was? So I'm going to give you the best way and the best information that I could get. This is the temple area in Jerusalem. That's the temple over there, and that's the courtyard over there. That place over there, the Roman guard barracks, that is where the scholars say Paul was being held. It's called the Antonia Fortress. The Antonia Fortress. I think I've got another picture over here of something similar. That's what it looks like a little bit more closer up. Now, I'm not sure when Paul was standing on the steps and he was busy preaching to the crowd, I'm not sure if it was at those steps over there, just outside of the temple. I'm not sure. I try to find out. Nobody can give me an answer. But so Paul is locked up in here, right? And now the question is, where does the Sanhedrin meet? And most of the scholars can't really tell me exactly where it is, but some guys say that is the place where it is. And that's called the Chamber of Hewn Stones, a specific room right next to the temple where the Sanhedrin would meet. And I had an image of that, of what it looks like on the inside a little bit earlier. So if you look at there in the background, then you see there is the fortress of Antonia. And then over here is where the Sanhedrin meets. So what Paul needs to do is, if the Sanhedrin calls this meeting, what does it mean? Paul has to be taken from that fortress over there and brought to the Sanhedrin. So I don't know if that meant that they had to go around the temple and come in, or there was some passageway through there where he could directly just come into the temple courtyard. I don't know. But there's a distance from there to there, and these guys are saying, let's get Paul out of the fortress, the barracks, to this meeting, and on the way there, we will take him out. So the goal was to assassinate and to ambush Paul. And they were about 40 guys. So the historians tells me that in the days of Paul and Jesus, there was a secret group of Jewish assassins who targeted the Romans and their supporters. They were dagger men. That's what they were called. Because they often concealed daggers and stabbed Roman soldiers as they walked by. And that seems to be sort of this kind of group. These 40 guys seems to be dagger men, ready to kill. They are used to killing Roman soldiers. They are ready to take on the Roman soldiers when they are bringing Paul from the barracks to the chamber. Well, I find it incredible. Look at what these guys do. Look at what they do. It's so interesting how immoral they are. And listen, in their attempt to protect God, that's really what they're doing. We must kill this guy because he's preaching things contrary to God, right? He's preaching nonsense. He's a liar. We need to wipe him out in honor of God. Very interesting. So they, if you read the text, I'll give you some of the words. They conspire, they plot, they form a pretext. In other words, a lie. They create a massive lie. They create an ambush, all in order to kill someone, to commit murder, because they are God's people. Now, let's think about that for a moment. The text says that they bound themselves under a curse. If you go back to the verses, I can go back there for you if you want. They bound themselves with an oath not to eat. The scholars would tell you that there's a curse built into this. When I read this, I thought to myself, these are some of the dumbest people you can find. I know exactly how they died. Would you like to know how they died? All 40 of them. They died of hunger, ladies and gentlemen. I won't eat again until Paul is dead. Well, he didn't die. Not by you. So they must have died of hunger and of thirst because they never killed Paul. But the Greek says that they placed themselves under the anathema. Very interesting Greek word that Paul uses in Galatians chapter 1, verse 8 to 9, when he talks about angels who preach a different type of gospel, and those angels must be an anathema. They must be totally destroyed. So when Paul uses, when Luke uses this word, he's saying these guys put themselves in a position to be totally destroyed by committing to a curse like this. On oath. They placed themselves under a curse of destruction. They were willing to, listen to it, they were willing to take the curse rather than accept Jesus. They would rather be cursed than submit to the Christ, like many people today. With the curse, they cursed themselves. They devoted themselves to total destruction if they didn't kill Paul. Now, Solomon warns us. This is the first text that came to my mind when I read this. Because Solomon warns us about making these types of vows and curses and things in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 4 to 6. When you make a vow to God, do not delay in fulfilling it. You got to hurry up, man. If you make this commitment and this promise and this oath and this vow, you need to get it done. He has no pleasure in fools. Fulfill your vow. It is better not to make a vow than to make one and not fulfill it. Do not let your mouth lead you into sin. And do not protest to the temple messenger, my vow was a mistake. Why should God be angry at what you say and destroy the work of your hands? Here is the thing. Because when you read this, what Solomon is referring to is that if you make some type of a vow and then you do it in the presence of God and then later you come and you say, well, I'm sorry, it was a mistake. You know, I didn't think this through. I mean, don't come to the temple messenger with that. And the idea was this, is that you could relieve yourself of the oath that you made or the vow that you've taken. If you come to the priest and you come with genuine repentance, that possibility was there. Now, here's the thing. These guys had the priests in their pockets because they go to the priests with this conspiracy. So they could easily make as if this oath that they have taken means nothing. They could make an excuse with the priests and absolve themselves so they could eat some steak. And they probably did do that because for them, making these types of commitments, if they're willing to commit murder and lie to the extent that they do, their word probably means nothing in any ways, and their promises are absolutely useless. Ladies and gentlemen, fools take oaths and make vows and make promises and not keep them. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. And if you're not going to keep an oath, rather don't make it. Because I guarantee you, you know, these guys didn't kill Paul. Well, you don't know it yet if you haven't read the text. But they ate again. I'm pretty confident about that. So they make this oath, which essentially places a curse upon them, but then they conspire to kill. Killing Paul was more important than food and drink for them. Can you imagine how intense that must be for you? I'm not going to eat again until I've killed this guy. What type of a heart do you have? What type of a mind do you have? The death of Paul was more of a priority to them than nursing their own bodies. They are ready to kill. Satan has entered them already, like Judas. They had already killed Paul in their hearts and in their minds. They've already decided. Satan has already overpowered their hearts and their minds. And then they inspire to lie. So first they put a curse on themselves, and then they conspire to kill, and then they inspire to lie. They go to the leaders, the spiritual leaders. They go to the chief priests and the elders, the text says. I did a little bit of search there because I wanted to find out exactly who did they go talk to. Who did they go to say, listen guys, let's make up this lie and ask for Paul to be brought to the Sanhedrin. The Greek word for chief priest is exactly the same word used in last week's text. It's the actual high priest. It is very likely that they went to the Sadducees. Now remember last week, the Sadducees were upset with Paul, right? Because he speaks about the resurrection of the dead and they don't believe in it. So it's very likely that these guys went to the Sadducees, the leaders of the Sadducees, the elders, and perhaps even the high priest, and asked them, let's do this lie thing. Now, if the Sanhedrin was being led by God, how do you think they would have handled the situation? They would have said to these 40 guys, hey, you guys are a bunch of liars and murderers. You need to be locked up. In actual fact, you know what's interesting? Who are the ones that's going to do the lie here? Who's going to tell the lie? The 40 guys or the spiritual leaders? The spiritual leaders are going to do the lying. Because they're going to say to the commander, hey, bring Paul. We want some more information from him to finish this case quickly. Jeez. Whenever there is a lie involved in your plans, it is an orchestration of Satan. That is his language. The language of Satan is lie. If you are making plans, if you want to start a new business, you want to make a profit, whatever it is, if it involves a lie, you can be sure it's not of God. So the idea is, let the commander think this is for a good cause, to get more information, to solve the case. Satan knows what to do to lure people into his cause. There are two ambushes here. The people planning the ambush are being ambushed by Satan. They think they are doing what is good and right, pleasing to God, but they are actually doing what's pleasing to Satan. And they don't even know it. And this is, ladies and gentlemen, why we have to practice introspection. We have to have quiet time to evaluate ourselves and to see carefully, because if we think that we are incapable of being deceived, we are making a big mistake. And I think some of these guys were deceived without knowing it. Let's see what happens further. So everybody with me, there's a problem. There's 40 guys conspiring to kill Paul. They're pulling in the Sanhedrin. They want to commit murder. What now? Well, enter this guy. But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul. Now, in the New Testament, I can only find three references to any of Paul's family. The one reference we read about last week, where Paul says he's the son of a Pharisee. So we know that his dad was a Pharisee. That's all we know about his dad. The second reference here is Paul's sister. And all we know about Paul's sister is that Paul's sister had a son. And that's the third person we know about, is Paul's sister's son. Now, I realized this evening as I was sitting here, I made a mistake by calling him a cousin. Everybody else calls him a cousin, it seems like, but what is he really? He's a nephew, right? So, here's this nephew, and what I find interesting is how many times in Paul's writings does he mention people's names? A lot, doesn't he? In the book of Romans, in chapter 16, he mentions the names of 28 people. That's a lot. But nowhere does he mention his family. It's like his family had become insignificant because they didn't do the will of God. And if you remember what Jesus said, that's the assumption that we can make. But remember what Jesus said? Those who do the will of my Father, that's my brother, my sister, my mother. And that's the only explanation. But what's cool here is that at last, we're in the 23rd chapter. It's like nearing the end of Paul's life. At least somebody in his family comes onto the scene. And I want you to imagine at this moment how Paul feels when he gets this news. What do you think is going through his mind? Well, people wanting him dead, that's nothing new, right? He knows exactly what that feels like. It's a death threat. It's literally a death threat. We have friends that we love dearly that received a death threat as well. They packed up their bags, they packed up everything, and they went to Australia for 3 months just to get away from it. I cannot imagine what that must feel like to know that people want you dead. It's no fun. It's possible maybe that Paul had a little bit of a doubt, like we would. He's human. Would this not be an easy way for Lysias to get rid of Paul and for his problem to go away? So what if Lysias hears about this and then he realizes, well, here's a nice trick to get rid of Paul and I can go on with my job and the problem is solved. Oops. 40 guys attacked us. Sorry, Emperor. 40 guys. We didn't see them coming. They had daggers and stuff. And they killed Paul. Oh, oops, sorry. Now the problem is off his hands. But remember, it was prophesied to Paul that trouble would be coming his way when he goes to Jerusalem. But ladies and gentlemen, God is amazing. God is amazing. He appears to Paul just before he hears about this conspiracy. It's like Jesus is there to tell you something before that you hear about the trouble. He gives you encouragement and promises just before the trouble hits, before Satan's plan is revealed. You see, because God's always one step ahead of Satan. And he says to Paul, you're going to Rome. So when Paul hears this message, I think that Paul knew these guys are just wasting their time. Because I'm going to Rome. They're not going to get it right. So God is incredible. Because Paul was being kept safe and secure in the Antonio fortress. And the historians tell me, you couldn't just have anybody go visit somebody in that prison. Well, it wasn't a prison, it was actually a guarding house where they had various soldiers, and it was built by Herod the Great. But it's still, Paul was under a type of arrest. And not anybody could just go in there and go visit Paul, except family members. So, you can understand why the Jews wanted to make a plot to kill Paul. They had to get him out of the place because nobody could go in. So, how did his cousin get in there? Because it seems like only family members could go in and visit. And in the midst of this satanic plot, God is two steps ahead. Somehow, somewhere, a family member of Paul. Coincidental, hey? The one person that could go see Paul hears about this plot. We don't know how it happened. What are the chances? God knows what he's doing. And as I was thinking through that, I came across Psalm 37, which is a beautiful psalm. And if you want to, just listen to what the text is saying. And it's so beautiful for me because as the world and Satan and these evil Jews and these liars and thieves and murderers are trying to kill God's people, look at what God does and how God views this. In Psalm 37 verse 1, it says, "Do not fret because of those who are evil, or be envious of those who do wrong. For like the grass, they will soon wither. Like green plants, they will soon die away. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and enjoy safe pasture. Take delight in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in Him, and He will do this. He will make your righteousness reward. Your righteous reward shine like the dawn, your vindication like the noonday sun. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for Him. Do not fret when people succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not fret. It leads only to evil. For those who are evil will be destroyed, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. A little while, and the wicked will be no more. Though you look for them, they will not be found, but the meek will inherit the land and enjoy peace and prosperity." Listen to this. "The wicked plot against the righteous and gnash their teeth at them, but the Lord laughs at the wicked, for He knows their day is coming. The wicked draw the sword and they bend the bow to bring down the poor and needy, to slay those whose ways are upright. But their swords will pierce their own hearts and their bows will be broken." While they plot, God laughs at them. Did you know that God laughs? He's laughing right here in Acts 23. You guys making plans. Mamparas. He probably didn't use that word, but he's laughing. He thinks it's funny. "You fools, you're going to get hungry. You're going to get hungry." Well, what happens next? "Then Paul called one of the centurions and said, 'Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him.' So he took him to the commander. The centurion said, 'Paul the prisoner sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you.' The commander took the young man by the hand, drew him aside, and asked him, 'What is it that you want to tell me?' Now this nephew," the text says, "that he's a young man." The Greek word for young man is neonios. Three men in Acts are given this term. The one is Paul himself, who's a young man when Stephen is being killed, when they laid their garments, outer garments, by the feet of the young man, Paul, giving approval to his death. The second time it's referred to is when Eutychus is in the third story. He's a young man in the window who falls to his death at Paul's preaching. By the way, are you awake, Cheryl? Yes. Okay. So now, thirdly, the third young man is this young man over here. Now, Neonios, it's so cool when I went to read what Strong's says about this Greek word. It's a young man up to the, a young man is a man up to the age of 40. And this week I had a midlife crisis because I saw how much hair I was losing and I realized I'm transitioning into becoming an old man. That's why I shaved it off. I wanted to be like Tim and like my brother Tom, you know. And then I come to this text and I say, "Well, God is so faithful because I'm under 40. God thinks I'm a young man." A centurion is the captain of 100 men. A commander is the chief of 1,000 soldiers. The commander treats Paul's nephew pretty well. He's willing to listen. Why? Because this is a sensitive issue that directly affects his work performance. He took him by the hand and allowed him to have a private audience with him. It's like he cared about Paul's nephew. It's like he cared about Paul. Or it's just something about Paul's nephew. Maybe he's approachable. Maybe he's humble. Maybe he's an unsuspecting person. But it's beautiful. I like this nephew of Paul because he's anonymous. We don't even know what his name is. But the Holy Spirit placed him in the Bible and showed us how God can use anonymous people to make a big difference in His kingdom. You don't have to have a big name and be famous to do something for God. Even though Paul knows that he would be going to Rome, he doesn't say to his nephew, oh, that's interesting news. Don't worry about it. Go home and sleep well. Paul's going to be okay. Interesting. I will be going to Rome. Jesus said, I'm going to Rome. So I don't have to worry about anything. Whatever these guys try, I'm going to be fine. Paul doesn't do that. He sends his nephew to the commander. Paul knew God does things, but he didn't know always how. So when the nephew arrived by him, he knew that this was God's working. It was God's way of keeping him safe. God does things through earthly means. It isn't always magical and miraculous. He uses people and circumstances to accomplish his will. He uses earthly means to achieve his purposes. He could heal you of cancer, but he will probably do it through doctors. He could save your marriage miraculously, but he will probably do it through a counselor or a life experience or a life event or the words of a child. Why? Because God has a multi-pronged approach, and through every action, he tries to include as many people as possible to extract the maximum amount of glory for himself. And that puts a spin on the people you meet in your life and the circumstances that you find yourself in, because God might be using those things. God speaks through them. You cannot despise or fob off any circumstances that you find yourself in, and you cannot push away the people that God puts in your life, because they're all part of God's plan. Paul, therefore, aligned his personal productivity with the promises of God. If God makes a promise, he doesn't mean, sit back and I will do it all. So he says, he makes a promise, doesn't he, in Matthew chapter 6. He says, don't worry about your life. Don't worry about your life, what you will eat, what you drink. Don't worry about that. We spoke about this a few weeks ago. What do you have to do? I just look at the birds. The birds, they cannot work in the ground and produce seed and create worms, but your Heavenly Father feeds them, even though they can't themselves do it. The birds are totally dependent on God, right? Are they? So that's a promise that God gives. He says, be like the birds. God will take care of you. But here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen. Does the bird just sit there in the tree and wait for the worm to fall in his mouth and the seeds to fall in his little nest over there? No, God makes a promise, but he wants to work in partnership with us. The bird has to use the wings that God has given him, fly, pick up the seeds, pick up the worms, and so live. So God makes promises, but he requires productivity from us. Another way of saying it is, God helps those who help themselves. So there's some truth to that. So he says, take him to the commander. He has something to say. That is wise, because he keeps it all a little secret. He doesn't even tell the centurion what the secret is. You never know how it might slip out and these guys could make a different plan. So he immediately does what Paul asked, because I can guarantee you that Paul had managed to build rapport with his captors. Paul was pretty good with that. We've seen that a few times with him. He was in the habit of befriending and baptizing prison guards. And I can guarantee you that he'd already prayed for this guy and he'd already taught him the gospel. All right, let's move on and then we'll close off. He said, this is Paul's nephew, some Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them, because more than 40 of them are waiting in ambush for him. They've taken an oath not to eat or drink until they've killed him. They are ready now, waiting for your consent to their request. The commander dismissed the young man with this warning: don't tell anyone that you have reported this to me. Lysias was frustrated that things don't get sorted. He wants to know, is Paul guilty or not? So this case can be closed and there can be peace in Jerusalem. So this suggestion that they are bringing to the commander is a great temptation that might just work in favor of Lysias' job requirements. But it backfires because God is involved in this process. So taking him by the hand, there's this gesture of civility and friendliness. He says to him, feel safe to speak. That's definitely not what the Sanhedrin had done to Paul. In the Sanhedrin, you get slapped in the face for just opening your mouth. In the barracks of the pagan, Roman soldiers lead you by the hand in civility and give you an opportunity to speak. This centurion was more interested in the truth than the high priest was. The Jews want to kill Paul. The Romans protect Paul. The Jews don't want to listen to Paul. The Romans listen to Paul in private. And the Jews don't understand. They don't understand why God is interested in the Romans and why God is interested in the pagans and why God wants the gospel to go all the way to the Gentile world. Here is why. They portray better character than the people of God. Shame on us in the day that atheists and pagans and the wokes have a better character than we do. He says to the young man, "Don't tell anybody that you have said this to me." Why? "To keep it a secret, that I will be doing something else with Paul, and that I will ignore this request if it does come from the Sanhedrin. And if they find out that their plot has been uncovered, they might create a new one." And next week we will find out what Lysias does to Paul and to the situation. Let's get to the most important part to close off tonight. Thoughts that came from my mind as I read this text. And this was maybe placed in my mind by Brother Dave this week. A friend loves at all times, but a brother is born for adversity. Those of you who were there on Wednesday night Bible study, you need to tell me exactly where in the book of Proverbs this is written. Otherwise, you guessed 25? Good guess, brother. You can't give a chapter. You need the verse. I'm just joking. Oh, brother. 17:17. Good job, brother. Proverbs 17:17. And it, maybe Paul's nephew wasn't even a Christian. We don't know. But when he hears of the plot of this murder against his blood relative, he jumps in and does something. And I think that's at the key of this verse over here. You might have family members, you might have friends, and sometimes your friends, especially your Christian brothers, are closer to you than even some of your blood relatives. But there's something interesting in blood relative relationships, is that when you really hit adversity, generally they will be there. They'll fly from the other side of the world for you, even though you don't talk every day. And maybe that's what the Proverbs writer is saying, and maybe we are witnessing that in Paul's case here. We don't see him at other places in the text, but when he hits adversity and he's about to be assassinated, his cousin or his nephew steps up and is willing to come forward. Now, I'm not saying this because there's a lesson in it, but simply, the reason why I mention it is because I think this is an example of the Proverbs of Solomon being true. The second thought that came to my mind is this: if God opens a door, no one can close it. And if God closes a door, no one can open it. God had opened the door for Paul to go to Rome. Nobody's going to close that door. God already said that's where you're going. People can do what they want. That door will not be closed. And we need to learn to walk through open doors and be careful of trying to force open closed doors. If it's closed, it's okay. Keep it closed. God doesn't want you to go through that door. People often say, "Well, I don't know what God wants me to do. I don't know what to..." Well, number one, is there an open door? Number two, if you go through the door, you're going to be sinning. If you're not going to be sinning, go through the door. God has opened it for you. If you have to sin to open a door, don't go through that door, right? Number three, sometimes your prison is meant to keep you safe, not to confine you. A few days before this event, Paul stood before the Sanhedrin. A few days before Paul stood before the Sanhedrin, he was walking around in Jerusalem freely. Remember, he was involved with the Nazarite vows of these other guys. He was in Jerusalem doing the sacrifices, right? He's walking around the temple freely, a free man. But on this day that his nephew visits him, is he a free man? No, he's not a free man. If he was free, what would have happened to him? He would have been dead. He would have been dead. He was in prison because he was being kept safe by God. The pagans kept him safe from God's so-called people. God was using a Roman barrack built by the evil Herod the Great to protect Paul from the Jews. Your business venture that doesn't want to move forward, your lack of funds to move to the next step, your car that breaks the day before you're supposed to leave on vacation, that could just be a wonderful way of God confining you, not trying to imprison you. And it's been placed there by God to protect us. So be careful of complaining about your prison. God has got this. And then lastly, thoughts and words are not as hidden as we think. These guys had this big secret. They're going to kill Paul. There's this plot. Somehow, out of all the people in Jerusalem, a family member hears the secret. It always comes out. It always comes out. I find it absolutely incredible how this plot leaked and how it leaked to exactly the right person. And here's why. God sees everything. God hears everything. And it made me think of Ecclesiastes 10, verse 20. Listen to this. Do not revile the king, even in your thoughts. Or curse the rich in your bedroom. Now your thoughts, that's a secret place, right? And your bedroom is a secret place. Nobody's there to listen in. Solomon says, don't even think it. And don't even say it in the most secretive place. Because a bird in the sky may carry your words. And a bird on the wings may report what you say. Now that's a whole other sermon for another day. But don't think, this is a powerful lesson I think, don't think or say things that you are not prepared for the whole world to see and hear.